All right, welcome back to NOTG. Today on Cracking the Code, we're going to talk about this topic. What are 10 of Singapore's property markets moat? And when we talk about moat, moat came about in popularity because of the legendary investor Warren Buffett. He talked about hunting for businesses with a very thick moat. So traditionally, if you look at in the olden days, let's just talk about like some of the Japanese castles that are beautiful in architecture. They usually have a moat surrounding the castle to protect the palace from enemies. And of course, the moat is like a defense system. And thus, the thicker the moat, the more protected the castle will be. So Warren Buffett always talks about moat in the sense that the thicker the business moat, the more in terms of popularity, will this business become in terms of appreciation of its stock price, very hard to disrupt, and they have more USP as a business itself. So similarly for Singapore, there are 10 moat that we have identified to be one of the key USP of the Singapore's real estate market because of its demographics, inherent factors, and of course a lot of policies, economic factors, the human factor itself. And most importantly, this 10 moats is going to help us to understand a macro picture, which will then help us to make micro decisions, and then it will help us to select what kind of real estate to invest in 2024 and of course beyond. Now, these 10 topics are, I would call it evergreen topics, because through the years of accumulation, we have reached today's status. And let me go through the first moat. 15 rounds of cooling measures. Now, why is this a good news rather than a bad news? Of course, it is a bad news for speculators, for real estate investors that in the past can purchase multiple properties at one go. They can sell, flip. They can even like flip the option. They can even like sell on 3 months later or the next day. So when there were no cooling measures, you'll notice that in terms of our real estate cycle, in terms of the graph, it is actually a very seasonal graph. So if you trend back in the past, real estate graphs looks like this. And before the year 2010, there were usually a lot of up and down swings. And even in 2013, when multiple rounds of cooling measures were initially introduced between round one from 2009 to round number nine in 2014, you will still see seasonal movements like this. But starting from 2016, in terms of the accumulation phase after the subprime crisis and once QE started, even though there were rounds and rounds of cooling measures that were gradually being introduced to now like the 15th round, you start to see that in terms of price movement, by right, it was like a very gradual movement up, uptake. But then because of COVID, there was too much pent-up demand and there was a huge amount of QE round that was being done in the global financial system, we see this huge acceleration. But now we're back to a nice, I would say, a single-digit growth on a year-to-year basis. Of course, that will also depends on what happens in the US. QE might or might not happen in the year 2024 because 2024 is being speculated that interest rates are going to come down after Fed pivot, and then we shall see. Now, let's come back to the 15 rounds of cooling measures. The rationale why this is good is because it stabilizes the market. Buyers that purchase residential properties will need to hold on for at least 3 years before they can sell without being taxed a seller stamp duty. That actually allows a more kind of stabilization, removal of speculation, mostly focused on serious mid to long-term property buyers and investors, primarily focused on buyers that are buying for own stay or even the second property that are ready to hold. And with ABSD, TDSR, lower LTV for second property. First property is 75%. Your second property, you can only loan 45%. All these multitudes of cooling measures stabilizes the market. And thus, this makes Singapore's property market a very nice, stable market to invest in, but yet not depleting and removing the potential of capital appreciation because the amount of land supply is being curated fantastically. Firstly, we're a country with limited land. The only way we can expand in land is to reclaim. Of course, you have seen like the Long Island project that's still in debate right now. The proposal of having that Long Island part as a water level protection system for the East Coast, but at the same time, allowing more housing to be built. That's of course like still in the talks right now. But the only way we can have more land is to reclaim. And reclaim land, of course, takes many, many years. And whatever is on our mainland is very, very limited. We have very limited land for even HDB condos and land that is not in production anymore. But this is a fantastic moat because anybody that wants to buy an asset, we always want to look at demand and supply level. If you're buying to a country that can have no control in terms of the amount that developers can build, that every year there's going to be so much more supply, then that kind of investment, I would say, is more like a rental play approach, provided the rental yield is great. But we always talk about real estate investment as more like a capital play or a rental play. If you're into capital play, Singapore is a place for capital play, especially in the residential market, provided you invest in the right kind of residential, provided you invest in the right kind of project. So third point, when you talk about the third point, this is talking about supply. This is removal of speculation and stabilizing the market. This is having that limited supply that increases the chance of capital appreciation. This is basically the increase in demand. So there's an increase of demand in Singapore because there's population growth. Anybody that comes in, they will firstly need to rent and they will eventually will want to buy or have to buy. The population growth portion is a very important part for the real estate market, because without human beings being attracted to a country, there's no additional prospect of buying into the property market. And with fueling demand and limited land, that increases a nice calibration for capital appreciation. Let's have a look at the fourth point. Fourth point basically is we have strong monetary policies, as well as our government is very, very in tune with policies that is relating to interest rate environment, that's relating to fiscal kind of policies. And of course, if you look at what the government has done in terms of SORA rates, now SORA rates, you have two choices. If you go for new launch properties, naturally, you have to follow the flexi rates, which is about 3.95 to 4% or even 4.1%. But if you go for fixed rates for completed properties, and you can get anything between 3.1 to 3.2% compared to US Fed rates that's as high as 7 to 8%. And we still hold one of the lowest mortgage interest rates in the world. If you go to cities, for example, like in some Southeast Asia countries, it can go as high as 8 to 10% in terms of mortgage interest rates. So in terms of our mortgage rates, because of the introduction of SORA rates, is much more controlled. And I think our government has done a good job to plan for that in advance. Coming to the end of 2024, SIBOR rates will be removed. Most all mortgage rates will then be focused on SORA. So let's have a look at the fifth USP. Fifth USP. Land is controlled by the state. Because of the way land is being controlled through government land sales, this is a very important element. Government decides how much land to be released on a quarter or a first half, second half basis of every year. Government will always calibrate the amount of supply based on the tender bid aggressiveness by developers. If they find that every land bid for new land by developers is getting more aggressive, prices are going up too strongly because there's so many developers bidding for the same plot of land and they are increasing their pricing aggressively and they are going to pass on this price to consumers, they will then try to release more land the next round in order to satisfy the demand from the ground. And thus, developers will then find that, hey, there's more land to bid. I don't need to be so aggressive this round. Maybe I can just taper off my aggressiveness for the next few rounds of bidding. So this is a fantastic policy that our government has set off. And of course, let's have a look at the next one, is that we are very different. You go and look at many countries. Most countries are 50% home ownership rate and 50% are tenants. Of course, huge countries have different kind of behavior demographics. For example, in certain big countries, the main capital is the attraction point that attracts all the different people that are coming from the outskirts of the country to flood into the center point of the country to find work. And thus, when they go in, they will definitely have to rent. And naturally, over there, there's going to be a high amount of tenants, either from overseas expats or internally from their own country. And that forms a very nice tenant pool for the country itself, for the capital itself. But of course, if the supply is not controlled, then naturally, no matter how many tenants they have, if the supply keeps increasing, then naturally the price appreciation will definitely flatten or plateau off. Singapore is very different in that firstly, the land is limited. Secondly, the amount that foreigners can buy is also being controlled by ABSD. Population is increasing. We want to attract people to Singapore because our birth rate is dropping. Interest rates want to be controlled because we don't want high interest rates that will affect our high ownership rates. And take note, because so many people own properties, government also cannot allow interest rates to flood too high because it's going to affect 9 out of 10 of the people that own properties. So every 10 people, there's 9 people that own properties, one do not own a property. So because of this, all these are tying in together. And they also want to make sure that we don't oversupply and collapse the property market. We still want like a stable growth for all types of property. And coming to the seventh portion here. And of course, let me just track back a little bit. Now, because of this, Singapore has a different kind of property play. In the sense that because so many people own properties, the benefit thus come towards the home ownership kind of status. Because people that own, they definitely have their first property as their primary own-state property. And thus, the stabilization effect is even stronger. Own-state property usually have a very low kind of possibility of a fire sale unless the family goes into a drastic situation where both spouses lose their job or they cannot, you know, even rent out certain rooms to supplement the monthly mortgage or cannot find a job within 24 months and things like that. They might downsize and maybe they will sell off their property at a slightly lower rate. But bearing in mind that Singapore unemployment rate is still very low, jobs are great, and of course, people are stable, economy is doing well, GDP is still healthy. High ownership rate usually caters to a stronger stabilization point in the country. Now, strong governance is also an attraction point for expats and foreigners coming to Singapore to work. And of course, strong governance creates more stability in the property market as well. And we also need to remember that we are of a global financial status. So this and this are both related. Because of this, we have a strong expatriates pool coming to Singapore, increasing our tenants' demand. So for people who own more than one property, basically our second property, usually they find that once you buy a private property that's near to the MRT station, even for HDB properties, it's very easy to rent out because tenants are looking for transportation needs, facilities, and most importantly, because of this strong expatriates pool, the rental demand remains strong, which was why that rental rates has been on a key topic in the last 2 years after the pandemic, that rates are soaring through the roof. Now in 2023, it has sort of stabilized. 2024, it should further stabilize. And thus, we're back to a more like a stabilization kind of market. Now, however, I talked about in the previous episode, there's a point number 10. And we need to talk about this, which is this. The grants in Singapore plays a huge portion of influence into the real estate market. Let me share with you why. Firstly, grants are fantastic. A lot of countries come to Singapore to learn about how Housing Development Board actually function and why it solves a lot of social issues. It creates a safety net for all Singaporeans to have a chance to own a property once you get married. I mean, like, if you look at the mechanics, as long as a couple, they have work, they qualify for grant, they can get near parents grant, first-timer grant. The moment they get married, even as young as 20 over years old, the amount of grants available to them as a first-timer for a resale property all the way is from 80,000 to 160,000. For BTO, there's also grants involved as well. And BTO not only has subsidized grant into the price of the BTO flat, it also has additional grants also based on your income level. And this solves housing issues. It creates safety status for all Singaporeans. However, underlying it is also a healthy injection of capital in the residential market. Why? Firstly, anybody that buys a resale property, let's say everybody averagely take a 50 to 80,000 grant per year based on the resale HDB transactions, that's already an injection of capital into every buyer's CPF. Because when you buy a resale HDB, the grants is actually called a CPF grant. It's being injected into you and your spouse CPF account. And the only way to utilize it is that it's a compulsory usage to go towards the down payment of your property. And thus, it is used to pay the down payment of your HDB resale property. If you buy a BTO, what's happening is that you purchase a BTO, let's say maybe in Punggol, 400,000. 5 years later, you sell it for 600,000. That 200,000 that you enjoy is actually the subsidized rate that the government injects into your property. Because by right, a five-year-old HDB will command about 600,000 in the resale market, but you're getting it for 400,000. You're getting that 200,000 being injected to you. And when you sell, that amount goes back to you. And when you talk about CPF grant, there's a myth in the market that you have to repay back to the government. You do not have to. Once the grant is being given to you, it belongs to you. The only time you need to repay back is through what we call the resale levy. Is when you purchase another round of BTO or subsidized property, then you have to repay back in terms of resale levy. But however, if you continuously buy resale HDB, condominiums, landed property, that grant that was given to you at your first HDB resale purchase, it belongs to you. So, and the only way to utilize it is naturally because it is a CPF grant. When you sell the property, you have to return back to your CPF OA and then you reutilize that for your next property. And thus, it is like an invisible injection into the whole residential market. So take note that this is actually a foundation boost to the residential market because this amount then gets floated into the private property market as well. So how does this work? So if you look at this, let's have an estimated assumption. If each year, averagely, there's usually about 25,000 resale transactions. If just assume on a very conservative basis, if half of them takes grant and not including the BTOs that's launched every year, for example. And of course, we have some key numbers right here. This is the amount of BTOs that are completed each year. Basically, 2019, 2020, 2021 means that they're going to get their keys. And this is the amount of BTOs reaching MOP each year. And of course, there are actually more ramped up supply of BTO launches in the next few years. For 2022, there's 23,000, 23,000 in 2023 as well. In terms of resale transactions on a year-to-year basis is usually at about 24,000 plus minus, maybe about 20,000 as well. Resale, the 2023, you're going to see 24,477 resale HDB that has taken place. So just take a very conservative amount. If half of the resale buyers takes grant, and we just take this half, and we take the 15,000 plus the 12,500, and let's just take 27,000 units in total times a 50K CPF grant subsidy being injected into the residential market. There's a total of 1.3 billion that's being created annually. And of course, this is the invisible support point of Singapore property market. And it's a very important element because this is the hidden stabilization engine. When subsidies are floated into BTO and HDB resale, it gets floated into other kinds of properties. Should this family decide to upgrade to a condo or a landed or other kind of real estate, utilizing their CPF funds, and that is basically the wealth that's being created in the Singapore real estate market. So sometimes because we're in Singapore ourselves, we fail to differentiate in terms of the different modes of the property market on Singapore versus other countries. And once you understand every country's demographics, thus every country has a different way of looking at the real estate market, being a property investor. If you want to invest in UK, you want to invest in Malaysia, you want to invest in the Philippines, you want to invest in US, there's different ways of looking at it because we need to understand the governance level, the financial status, the financial hub status level, the land supply level, the demand level, whether there are any restrictions, how about the interest rate policies, are the land being controlled, and basically are there a high rental demand, what is the ownership rate, and there's different ways of looking at things. But importantly, if this is your first time looking at the Singapore property market, or you're contemplating on whether you should go into the market, having an understanding of these 10 macro factors, I hope that it will help you in your journey. And of course, we're coming to the end of 2023. And I just want to wish everybody a wonderful Merry Christmas and Happy New Year ahead. And we hope to see you in 2024 having a stronger year. Take care.